The Theosophical Society in America presents Joy Mills, The Important Principles of the Secret Doctrine, Tape 3.
So again and again, this is, it's a protective. So Maya provides, it's also a very real protection. And this is important. We really can't take too much light, you know. We really can't. What do we want to do? We want to continually veil ourselves from it. And so Lama Govinda points out that if we call Maya a reality of a lower degree, we do this because illusion rests on the wrong interpretation of a partial aspect of reality. Compared with the highest or absolute reality, all forms in which this reality appears to us are illusory because they are only partial aspects and as such incomplete. The only reality which we could call absolute is that of the all-embracing whole. So each partial aspect must therefore constitute, as it were, a lesser degree. It's a veiling all the way. And Lama Govinda then proceeds to use a marvelous analogy. To a point-like consciousness, the continuity of a line is inconceivable. For such a consciousness, there exists only a continual and apparently unrelated origination and passing away of points. To a linear consciousness, we could call it, he says, a one-dimensional consciousness in contrast to the non-dimensional point-like consciousness, the continuity of a plane would be inconceivable because it can only move in one direction and only comprehend this linear relationship. And then he goes on to a two-dimensional consciousness, the continuity of a plane, that is the simultaneous existence of points, straight lines, curves, and designs of all kinds are conceivable, but not the spatial relationship of planes as they form, for instance, the surface of a cube. And then in three-dimensional space consciousness, the relationship of several planes is coordinated, but they cannot be conceived and grasped in their totality. So as he points out, the consciousness of a higher dimension consists in the coordinated but simultaneous perception of several systems of relationship or directions of movement in a wider, constantly growing more comprehensive unity without destroying the individual characteristics of the lower stages, you see. The reality of the lower is not annihilated by a higher one, but it's relativized. Do you see? Now, then he points out, therefore, that Maya, as something that has become, that is frozen and rigid in form, is illusion because it has been torn from its living connections and limited in time and space. And then he uses this marvelous analogy, which to me at least is extremely helpful. The body of an enlightened one is Maya, not in the negative sense, because it is the conscious creation of a mind that is free from this limited aspect, no more bound. Only for an unenlightened worldling who is still enmeshed in ignorance and delusion, the visible form of or personality of a Buddha is Maya in the ordinary sense of the word. And he concludes, the body of an ordinary human being is Maya, and also the body of an enlightened one is Maya, because any form is Maya. Do you see? It is the function, therefore. But that does not mean that the body of an ordinary man can be called a nirmanakaya. The difference is that the body of an enlightened one is his conscious creation, that of an unenlightened one, the creation of his subconscious drives and desires. Both are Maya, but the one is conscious, the other unconscious. The one is the master of Maya, the other its slave. The difference consists in prajna, knowledge, knowing, wisdom. That's all, that's the only difference, is in what you know. Simple, isn't it? You see. So this
so
is
Maya makes consciousness possible, yes, but not automatic.
But not automatic, yes. Mm-hmm. Sylvia?
Would the enlightened one then be part of the revealing principle?
Yes, probably so. And this is what, in the Bhagavad Gita, very simply, Krishna illustrates throughout. He is conscious of what, you know, he took the form of a charioteer consciously. And by chapter 11, because Arjuna is pushing him, says, I'd like to see, you know, this supreme form. So Krishna says, all right, I'll show you. And what happens? Arjuna says, this is too much light. Let's get back to just being good friends here and talking together, you see. Arjuna really couldn't face it. It's a marvelous, there it is in the Bhagavad Gita. Very simple, very easy. So it is this which makes possible all of our perception. But all perception is limited, distorted. And our function is, this is our unique function then, you see. But it's all present, you see. So HPB, in speaking of the first shloka of stanza 4, in this differentiation process, the universal mind is not at all a way up there. It is here and now. We are but moments of that light. It is our very self. Inside and outside, we are nothing but that light. Even our outer structure is the impress of its thought. And it is for this reason that in actual truth, man is the measure of all things and contains within himself, even within his physical body, all the wonders of the universe.
Where is that from?
I'm sorry, that's from Prem and Ashish. I thought it was the secret diary. It's man the measure of all things in the discussion of Shloka 1 of Stanza 4. There is another very excellent source on this which helps to express it, and that is an essay by the great German scholar Heinrich Zimmer, whose early death was deprived the world of a great deal of information. Some of his work was completed, of course, by Joseph Campbell. This is in a book called Spiritual Disciplines. It's a collection of essays from the Evanos conferences, so it's called the Evanos Yearbook Number 4, published by Princeton University Press in the Bollingen series. And it's the very first article in the book, in fact, Spiritual Disciplines, and I know we have it in our library here. Zimmer's essay is called The Significance of the Indian Tantric Yoga. And he points out that it is Maya which differentiates all the forms in the microcosm and macrocosm and unfolds them as divine forces made manifest. But he points out that this is the Shakti, this is the, as he calls it, the powerful volcanic Shakti, Maya, it is, it erupts, if you like, makes it apparent that it is all then a matter of consciousness. It is the power, the function of consciousness in its various forms. As he puts it, all the gods of the world dwell in our body, where they represent the same forces as they do in the macrocosm. This is part of our own third object, you know, to explore, because the laws of the universe, the laws of nature, are exactly repeated in the powers latent in man, not in the animal, not simply psychic powers then, but in man, the deific powers, as is said in the first letter from the Master. So as Zimmer puts it, we all sit in the web of our world. I love that. We all sit in the web of our world, which we have wrought with the projections of our Shakti. It is the Maya in which we are caught. To overcome this nature-given imprisonment, the yogi learns to develop out of himself in inner visualization a structure corresponding to the spider web. He himself is its center and source. He weaves it into a circular design of the world filled with figures, or into a linear diagram of symbols representing the world or the divine forces which unfold into macrocosm and microcosm. This structure we hold, then, as our reality, and by degrees take it back into ourselves. We assimilate it. We eat up the world. It is this power, you see. But we learn to see, as he says, he learns to see through his shakti proliferating in hourly cosmogony, and to take the play of her projections as that which the world is for God, as maya, which he inwardly permeates and governs, but which does not touch him. So there is much that we can begin to understand about this tremendous principle. It is a tremendous principle, which is all the time present. It is our own ability to project. And, of course, as psychology is recognizing, we do this all the time. We do it, strangely, in projecting on others our own weaknesses, our own shadow, you see? And in one of the Indian systems, it is said that a mark of the true adept is that he casts no shadow. So we draw the projection into ourselves. Because to cast a shadow, you see, is indeed to project onto others. By this power, it's within us. It's not something outside. And it expands that point of consciousness then to the mind that embraces the universe. And no projection then. You are the universe. It is within you. So what do we do with this, you see? Do we continue to project it onto others, to project our shadows? This, of course, was very much part of Jungian psychology, as you know, this projection onto others. And this searching through the world, then, for that other part of ourselves and all of this, you see. This is part of that whole tradition, that we search everywhere for that other part of ourselves, until we realize it's all within ourselves. This is, of course, ultimately the heavenly man taking back within the archetype all that we have really. Everything is a part of ourselves. I am a part of all that I have met. I think that's Whitman saying it. So it's a tremendous energy, and we have it. We have it at our disposal, and we use it whether we're conscious of it or not. And that's why Lama Govinda says that the body of the enlightened man is his conscious creation, whereas ours is unconscious due to the actions of the law, karma we call it, but the actions of the law. I may be leaving you in some utter confusion, but that, I hope, will lead you to your own further studies in the secret doctrine. Find these principles and apply them. I come back to what I said at the outset. As we live the life, we begin to come to this. As we probe, as we begin to really search and explore, build your own diagrams. This is, of course, the danger, the very real risk in my presenting some of these diagrams is that you may take them as fact. They are merely description. They are descriptive. They are metaphors. They are not the way things are at all. And I've developed so many different ones through the years, and then cast them aside and then bring them back and so on. So build your own. Discover these principles and discover how they begin to work in you. For example, this great principle, this function of maya, if we gain at all an insight that this is what we are doing all the time, that we are projecting, that we are using this, all the time, we suddenly begin to see things in a new way, don't we? We have new insights that this is our own power. You see, Fohat is present within us. It's our own dynamism. I've often called what psychology calls the libido, our personalized Fohat. You see, it's our energy. We use it. And it, what does it do? It leads us astray, but it can also lead us onto the correct ways. So these are all principles within us. Now, I'm going to turn to another rather difficult, quite abstruse doctrine, but I think an extremely interesting doctrine, one of the most profound and subtle concepts, which is that all of existence, therefore, all of this realm which we have called the Mayavik, the realm of projection, psychic projection, is built out of principles. This is a point that I made the very first night in our introduction, that we begin to see that it is not matter but principles or elements, rudimentary element principles, if you like. The concept of elements, of course, is found in the ancient traditions, in the esoteric philosophy, and in modern science. But I'm not speaking of these elements as what we think of as the chemical elements, necessarily, by any means. But these are ancient elements which are the principles of, which have both a functional aspect and what we may call a, what shall we call it, an aspect of force side. Maybe that's the best. They are therefore referred to in the literature as the tattvas. Now, HPB makes the statement, and this is in her esoteric writings, in the Adyar edition, it's volume 5, page 469, and she devotes quite some time to it, and it's extremely valuable. Dr. Timney also devotes quite a bit to it as the principles and functions. In other words, within this realm of existence are functions then which reflect themselves as shaktis, as powers, if you like, and I've merely given them there, but she calls them, or they are called in the Hindu literature, in the Indian literature, tattvas. Tat means that one ultimate reality about which nothing can be said, that primal reality, plus tva, which means simply ness, the nessness of something. So it is the thatnesses. Now this comes back to HPB's statement, very clear, existence is one thing. Existence is one thing. Now, not in the sense of thingness, but in the sense that it stands forth, but it is one. And it's standing forth, it is simply one. But there are within that one, then, the, how shall we put it, the principles which permit of differentiation. And so they're what I call the fields of thatness. I think it helps us to get away from this idea of the planes of nature as a kind of layer cake structure, you see. But there are fields of thatness which are all present here. They are all present here. This is pointed out in the Mahatma letters. It's pointed out in the Secret Doctrine. In the fifth volume, as I say, HPB says, it's a marvelous one, the universe came out of tattva, or the tattvas. It goes on by the instrumentality of the tattvas. It disappears into the tattvas. By the tattvas is known the nature of the universe. There it is, right there. We could stop now. That's the whole process of existence. She continues, however, the tattvas being simply the substratum of the seven forces of nature. There are seven forms of prakriti, as Kapila's Sankhya, the Vishnu Purana, and other works teach. Prakriti, of course, is nature. matter, primordial and elemental. Therefore, logic demands that the tattvas also should be seven. They are both substance and force, or atomic matter and the spirit that ensouls it. Marvelous, you see. So that's why it's a very interesting concept. It's not an easy one, but it's a very, very important one. They are, in other words, the divine aspects, if you like, functions of different kind, different manners in which the one reality works and gives expression to its own infinite nature to accomplish different kinds of objects in manifestation. We can perhaps see it best in the quotation that H.P.B. gives from the Vishnu Purana in regard to what is termed the dissolution of a universe. Often if you see how a universe dissolves, you'll see how it gets into being, you see. And in observing this reversal of the whole emanational process, it's a marvelous. This H.P.B. quotes the Vishnu Purana in volume 1 of The Secret Doctrine, page 372. You want to look it up. When by dearth and fire all the worlds are withered up, the progress of elemental dissolution is begun. First, the waters swallow up the property of earth, which is the rudiment of smell. And earth, deprived of its property, proceeds to destruction and becomes one with the water. When the universe is thus pervaded by the waves of the watery element, its rudimental flavor is licked up by the element of fire. The waters themselves are destroyed and become one with the fire, and the universe is therefore entirely filled with flame, which gradually overspreads the whole of the world. While space is enveloped in flame, the element of wind seizes upon the rudimentary property or form, which is the cause of light. And that being withdrawn, all becomes of the nature of air. The rudiment of form being destroyed, deprived of its rudiment, air extinguishes fire and spreads over space, which is deprived of light, when fire merges into air. Air then, accompanied by sound, which is the source of ether, extends everywhere throughout the regions, until ether seizes upon contact, its rudimental property, by the loss of which air is destroyed, and ether remains unmodified, devoid of form, flavor, touch, and smell. It exists unembodied and pervades the whole of space. Akasha, whose characteristic property and rudiment is sound, occupies the whole containment of space. But then the radical element devours sound. So you get the devouring principle, you see, and the succession. So the tattvas are simply explained in this way, that first is that primordial. Adi means first. That's all it means. Adi means first. In that sense, it does and does not give rise to the second, anupadika, which is simply a word that means parentless. Simply a word that means parentless. These two withdrawing, it is said, into silence and darkness, leaving then the broad expanse that we have called akasha, which is indeed said to be the third of the tattvas, so that it is equated with the Greek term of ether. Its principal quality, its rudimentary function, if you like, being sound. We've already mentioned this. It is the sounding board. At times this is referred to as Shabda Brahman in some of the literature. Shabda being sound. It is the word. In the beginning was the word, and the word was with God, the very mystic writing of the Gnostic St. John, you see. So this is indeed, from that level, the creative process beginning, sound, which then makes possible hearing at our level. It is that then which gives rise to light or tajasa fire. Now, in another respect, and one has to be careful of this, because in the Mahatma letters, fire is also said to be, indeed, this is the first element, or that is to say, it is the ultimate element. And this is brought out in a very lengthy letter, which is a very complicated letter, so I won't attempt to read it all by any means. But if you'd like to pursue this, it's in the series of question and answer letters in which the Master K.H. responded to questions put by A.O. Hume. And it's published as letter 15 in the Mahatma letters. And here it is explained. The ancients speak of the five cognizable elements of ether, air, water, fire, earth, and of the one incognizable element, the sixth principle of the universe, call it Purusha Shakti, and so on. And the master gives this whole list there, not calling them necessarily the tattvas, but they are indeed that. And if you'd like to, again, study further on it, the Blavatsky lecture, which is available in the bookstore, I know, of 1984, was written by one of our really excellent students in England, Janine Miller, on the flame divine. And this deals with this whole subject. Time doesn't permit us to get into it in detail. So this means, as HPB says in the Secret Doctrine, every new round develops one of these elements. And therefore, the next comes as Tajasa, fire, which by sight produces form, rupa. But with light, which makes sight possible, form can emerge. The fifth is said then to be vayu, air, which makes touch possible, sparsa. These being then the five means by which we contact our universe. Apas, air, water, said to be the watery element, which of course often is equated with the astral or the plane of kama. Taste is possible, and the seventh element principle of prithivi or earth producing smell. So that these men give rise, it is also said, to the various, by the action, it is said, of the what are known as the gunas, that is to say, by the action of the attributes of substance itself, bring about the various organs of the physical body. I think somebody, yes, Donald was speaking of this tremendous principle. Taste is possible, and the seventh element principle of prithivi, or earth, producing smell. So that these men give rise, it is also said, to the various, by the action, it is said, of the what are known as the gunas, that is to say, by the action of the attributes of substance itself, bring about the various organs of the physical body. And I think somebody, yes, Donald was speaking of this tremendous principle that our very organs then reflect these interior fields of thatness. The entire subject is perhaps almost too much to attempt to go into now, but I bring it forward because what we are dealing with is that all of this is present here. Often we think, you see, that we have to leave the physical, then we get to the astral or kamic, then we have to leave that and we get to the manasic and then to the buddhic and we climb up this peculiar ladder. What is suggested is that all of these element principles are here. These are the fields of thatness which are now present within us. We get this also in a marvelous statement in the Bhagavad Gita, for example. Krishna says, Only some know me truly. Earth, water, fire, air, space, mind, understanding, and egoism. This is a lower form of my nature. Know that there is another form of my nature, and higher than this, and by which this universe is upheld. All this is woven upon me like numbers of pearls upon a thread. I am the taste in water. I am the light of the sun and moon. I am sound in space, the fragrant smell in the earth, refulgence in the fire. So this is the total body of the cosmic man, the heavenly man. All of this. And there we have it in the Gita again. The Gita is a marvelous source book, you must know, for all of this teaching. It's you know, within 18 short chapters, it gives you the entire philosophy, if you like. It introduces you to it. So only some know me truly. These are the, of course, the rishis, the Dayan Chohans. But here is the lower form from 3 down through 7. Adi and Anupadaka, in silence and in darkness. All this is woven upon me, and we are the reflection of that. Now, that then, becoming the form side, is reflected in the great powers or shaktis, which HPB outlines in volume 1, pages 292 to 293, by quoting one of the most remarkable of the early theosophists, for whom she had a great regard, and indeed for whom the masters had a great regard. Unfortunately, he died quite young, and unfortunately, too, he was not one who felt that this knowledge should be shared with the barbarians of the Western world. And although he was originally supposed to have cooperated in the writing of the secret doctrine, he declined that. Tisa Barot, marvelous works. We don't have very much of his, of course. His philosophy of the Bhagavad Gita, I think, is one of the really rich sources of the whole metaphysical background. And, of course, in the book of his essays published as his esoteric writings, which is now back in print, we have some remarkable essays. Parenthetically, I might add, I like it very much because it's the only place in our literature in which there is an essay on women adepts. So that's one reason I think he's rather a remarkable person, you see. Esoteric writings, the esoteric writings of Tisa Barot. Mm-hmm. But HPB, of course, again and again quotes him quite with approval, quite naturally. He was a Vedantin scholar. And she quotes him here in regard to these forces, as she says, mystically defined. And points out that it is all esoteric, and she adds in her usual way, though not covering the tenth part of what might be said. And she says that each one of them could take up a volume on its own. She says the enumeration alone of the yoga powers would require 10 volumes. So you can see, it may have been a bit of hyperbole on HPB's part, but nevertheless, she is giving us here, then, and I bring this in because it's related to the fields of thatness, that is to say, to the element principles, in terms of their forces, in terms of that which ultimately man, the heavenly man, must utilize fully, in full self-consciousness. And I bring it in because there is such an interest today in all of these sort of psychic powers, which these are not. Above all, these are not. And because perhaps at times we forget that the third object of the society does refer to powers latent in man, meaning thereby the fully human powers which are reflections of those universal powers possessed in the heavenly man, the pattern of the universe. And I come back to this. This is the pattern of the universe. And so I've listed them there. The seventh, which he says, and which, of course, Tissa Barrow says, the seventh, which comprehends them all, the primary, she calls it, the primary, the seventh, the mother, in the mystical sense, is known as Divi Prakriti. That is, that original cosmic causative principle. Because within Prakriti is indeed this KR. There in the Sanskrit, it's KR, the dot under it, because R is not a consonant, it's a vowel, a sound in Sanskrit, is the root of our word karma, of course, and has to do with the causative principle. We want to come back to Fohat, you may, or Maya. It's the causative principle. And pra is simply primordial, early, the beginning, the original causative principle. Divi is a form of the word deva or dev, or from the root div, which is, of course, to shine. It is now within the manifested universe, but it is the primordial causative principle from which all then of the shaktis or energies or forces or powers flow. And it summarizes all of them. They are all within then that, as all of these five are within Adi Anupadika. And so they are neatly listed for us as Parashakti, which is literally the great or supreme force or power. It means and includes the powers of light and heat. Jnana Shakti, literally the power of intellect or real wisdom or knowledge. Real wisdom or knowledge. And has two aspects. When placed under the influence or control of material conditions. Ichcha Shakti, literally the power of the will, its most ordinary manifestation is the generation of certain nerve currents which set in motion such muscles as are required for the accomplishment of the desired object. In other words, these are already present within us, unconscious in their use. Kriya Shakti, the mysterious power of thought, which enables us to produce external perceptible phenomenal results. Then Kundalini Shakti, which unfortunately has been so abused, misunderstood, and misused, and I think part of our function really may be, as theosophical students, to set it right in the world, to give the correct interpretation of what is meant here. Of course, literally, it's the power which moves in a serpentine or curved path, the universal life principle, therefore. And therefore, having to do with an awakening of that real understanding, and incidentally, therefore, in its movement, producing then real knowledge, real wisdom in its movement upwards. It's rather interesting, for example, in the Christian tradition, and I'll just throw this in, the Christian tradition, the crucifixion always takes place on a mount, Golgotha, the place of the skull, because within, indeed, man's own skull is that bringing together of that electric energy which produces a transformation, a new stage of knowing. Much more than simply the manipulation of external forces. And finally, Mantrika Shakti, which there's a great deal of interest, also literally the force or power of letters or speech or music. Often we think of mantras simply as the recitation of particular, shall we say, mantrams of particular invocations, the most sacred, of course, in India being the Gayatri Mantra. But it has to do with the fact that every word you utter, every sound has its effect. Every sound. What is the sound of the self? In the Tibetan Book of the Dead, ultimately one has to hear the sound of the self as 1,000 thunders roaring. What is that sound? What then do we repeat? So it has to do right here with our life.
Sound is meant slightly more than literal.
Yes, that's right. Because every atom then, every one of the in the fields, every principle, every element principle has its sound. We have here that wonderful film that was done many years ago, Unheard Melodies, the work of Dr. Donald Hatch Andrews, in which every atom, as it were, has its sound. So what is the sound of you as you move through the world? The sound of the physical body as you move it through the world. It was Emerson, of course, who said, "What you say, what you are speaks so loudly I cannot hear the words you say," which is the fact that there is an interior sound of our being. So this is indeed at the very physical level, everything, the very constitution. So to conclude then, let us look at this then in terms of the new diagram, which I have put above there, which is the whole, which is the Greek way, Plato's way, perhaps, in which we can look at the movement that is to be made. The movement that is to Sophos, we, each one of us, being Theos, the pilgrim, that which is in the becoming, each one of us becomes that God in the making, if you like, but the very word Theos being Teian, to become, to open from within outwards towards Sophos, our mother's home, if you like, the matrix of the mystery of our own being, to use Günther's terminology, or Sophos wisdom, full knowing, full realization, which now repeats itself in this marvelous manner in the ordering principle, logos, the true for Plato. This, of course, is the true, if you like, which is the ultimate ordering principle throughout the universe, and it is man that reveals the order by his very being, reveals through the fields of thatness by use of his own internal powers, his own internal energies, functioning consciously, reveals then the order that is present and measures it, metron, measures it, which in its measure becomes the beautiful. Metron is indeed the beautiful. It is that measurement which is right proportion, everything in its proportion, never therefore fully satisfactory. Jake and I were just discussing before our reconvening, because it is always in proportion, but never fully exact, always an approximation. Hence the first great truth of Buddhism, that all existent, all sentient existence, all that stands forth from the primal reality is dukkha, which is usually translated in most of the texts as suffering, which I think is a very bad translation, frankly. It is that there is not an exactness. It is always in proportion, and the proportion, when it's out of proportion, produces what we think of as suffering or pain. Günther translates dukkha as unsatisfactoriness, and I translate it as approximation. Everything that stands forth is only an approximation. It's just as though, if, like me, you are short-sighted, you see, everything, when I take off my glasses, is slightly blurred. You know, you all look a bit blurry. Now, is that blurriness in you or is it in me? You see, I say, you are blurred. Don't I? Hmm? And I project it, you see. You appear blurred. But you say, I'm not blurred, I'm very definite here, you see. So what is clear-sightedness? What is sophos or vidya? Clear seeing. So, but this is metron, and the true and the beautiful in their unity produce arete, or the good, which Bev and I were discussing. The true and the good produce the beautiful. The good and the beautiful produce the true. And all of them lead to that central point, the grail, if you like, the grail symbol, the mother's home, the matrix of all existence, vidya, knowing, or in the Greek, of course, sophos. And so we return, the three having fallen into the four, now return to the three and to the one, the center. So there, in one essence, and part of it at least, is the secret doctrine. You make it unsecret. You reveal it.